Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hi there, this is Sean Eastridge, host of Missing Frames, the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. Thanks so much for tuning into this very special Between Takes episode of our show. So, if you're not already aware, I've been covering the 2019 Atlanta Film Festival over the past weekend, and I'll be continuing to cover it all week. You can keep up with all the awesome stuff I'm doing, all the photos, all the videos. It's all on our social media pages. What are those, you ask? How dare you? You should be following us already. But I'll cut you some slack. We're on Twitter, at JoinNerdParty, and on Instagram, at TheNerdParty. You can like our Facebook page, too, if you want, but then you'll miss out on all the wonderful Instagram stories I'm doing. That's what the people love. Kids love Instagram stories. But this is going to be the first of a series of interviews I'll be releasing over the week. I got to sit down with Joseph Cross, the director of Summer Night, and one of the film's producers, Audrey Tomasini. Audrey is Joe's wife, or is Joe Audrey's husband? I'll let you decide on that. Seriously, though, Joseph and Audrey are such genuine and awesome people, and they were incredibly generous with their time. Joseph's been acting since he was a kid. You probably recognize him in films like Wide Awake, which, by the way, was M. Night Shyamalan, one of his early movies, pre-Sixth Sense. He was also in Jack Frost. Yes, that's the film where Michael Keaton becomes a snowman. But he's also been in films like Flags of Our Fathers, Milk, Lincoln. And he's recently appeared in such amazing TV series as Mindhunter and Big Little Lies. This guy is an incredible actor. And now I can genuinely say he's an incredible director too. Summer Night is his debut feature. And it's so good. It's basically a coming-of-age dramedy in the vein of like American Graffiti, Dazed and Confused. But it follows this tight-knit group of friends through one evening as they kind of fall in and out of love and struggle with personal things. And it's really good. It's genuinely funny. It's heartfelt. Joseph and Audrey have assembled an incredible cast, which includes L.R. Coltrane, which is like, he's from Boyhood, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. Justin Chatwin's in this. You've got Victoria Justice, Annalee Tipton, Lana Condor, Hayden Cito, who, by the way, makes a Stan Lee cameo in this interview. So keep your ears peeled, people. We talked about all sorts of stuff about the production, some of the challenges of being a first-time director and a first-time producer, some of the struggles they ran into. There was a financing mishap where one of their financiers actually lied and didn't have any money to contribute. And the amazing Georgia crew actually got together and raised the money to finish the film so they wouldn't have to shut down production, which is not something that happens. I mean, it's an incredible story. We also talk about how Joseph's experiences as an actor informed his directing style. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much good stuff in this interview. Fair warning, we recorded this in a restaurant, so the sound quality is a little off. But you know what? I'm going to go ahead and just claim it's an artistic decision. You really feel like you're in the restaurant with us. Does that make sense? Let's just go with that. It's an artistic decision. I'm a creative genius. I'm like the Kanye West of podcasts. I don't know what I'm saying. I'm sorry. Also, another warning, we do kind of have some mild spoilers about the plot. In fact, it's probably best if you want to go in fresh to go see the movie. It's going to be out in a few months on streaming platforms and in a limited theatrical release on July 12th. So if you want to bookmark this page, come back and listen then. Totally cool. I won't hold it against you, but feel free to check it out now. There's tons of great anecdotes about directing and filmmaking and just some really cool stuff. And I also want to give a shout out to Tara Ansley, who is another producer on this film, and she helped set the whole thing up. So without further delay, let's get into this.
Now available to own on video cassette.
All right, well, thank you both so much. This is awesome. The movie is so good. I think you guys really hit the notes you were going for when we were talking beforehand. So how is it? Is this the first time? I mean, it's the world premiere, but is this the first time you've watched it with
an audience. So how was that? Like,
it's, yeah, I mean, it's the third time I've watched it with an audience.
Okay.
I mean, we would do a lot of like little test screenings when we were in the edit, where we would bring in like 3, 4, 5 people, you know what I mean? But never more than 5 people crammed in a little room. So the first time we saw it with an audience was in LA. We did just like a friends and family screening.
Okay.
So that was cool, but it was a lot of people, everybody was involved. And then the second time was our buyer's screening, which is like the polar opposite of a festival audience.
That's the pressure of like, please buy this, we need.
Yeah, you know, and you can feel people are there watching it, debating whether or not it makes sense for them to buy it, you know what I mean? Yeah. So they're not just there for the pure enjoyment of the experience. So last night was by far the biggest audience that we've ever had watch it. And I mean, so engaged and amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it was so much fun. I mean, they were applauding at the moment with Rabbit with the lemon, which I never dreamt of people applauding at that moment, which is amazing. We got laughs that we had never gotten at certain points before, which was great. I mean,
I was gonna ask, was there any, like, were there moments where you were like, because I was sitting a couple rows back from you, so I would peer over to see how you two were reacting, and if it was like baffling to see certain laugh moments or things that you were like, I was not expecting that.
Yeah.
What were some of the bigger moments?
I mean, it was just like, well, there were two moments in the movie. Like, there's the moment between Seth and Mel when his phone goes off in the bedroom.
Okay.
And then there's the moment with Rabbit with his lemon that are both these sort of like heightened reality moments. And I got a lot of notes on them from people because people would be, you know, just watching it at home on their computer with their screener, being like, I don't know if these moments play. And I always sort of believed, like, you know, I think that once we're in a big audience and people are in the film, they're going to be funny and they're going to get big laughs. And I was, like, so happy to be...
Well, you put two pair of eyes, like, across a giant screen in a movie theater, and it's a more dramatic kind of shift from reality than when you're just sitting at your home, like, TV. So I think that, you know, I think there were some moments, and I can't remember them all at this moment, but that were just little gags that were kind of, like, very small things in people's eyes or very minute shifts in the character that the actors were doing that played so well on the big screen because you could really see it.
Yeah.
Specifically, I was thinking about the moment when, which has always been a funny point, when Justin Chatwin is sitting in the booth with Victoria Justice, and she's like, do you like babies? And he just has this moment, and it's so funny because it's very subtle, but it's very funny. And everyone got a big laugh from that.
And festival audiences are typically amazing. You know, people are coming because they love movies and they're really excited to watch movies. So, I mean, I was just really looking forward to this and it was just so much fun. And because we've already sold the movie to a distributor, we don't have the same
pressure
that a lot of people have at their first festival screening. Right, where they're thinking like, oh my God, is anybody going to buy my movie? Is anybody going to put it out? So, yeah, we were able to really just kind of sit back and enjoy it with everybody else.
So it feels like, right from the get-go, you have this crazy shot of just like, you've got the guy on the bike and you're riding through the woods and you come out over the water. I mean, were you like, look, let's just go for broke with this opening shot. I really want to immerse people. But also, it felt to me like an announcement of you as a director. Like, let's just like do something really awesome and bring it
up. Yeah, so that opening shot, you know, a big part of like, one of my really good friends, Justin Lerner, who's a filmmaker, I did a movie called The Automatic Hate with him, and he's hugely helpful in this movie, but when he read the script, his note was, you know, you've got the first 5 minutes to teach people how they're going to sit in their seats for the rest of this movie.
Right.
And you need to let people know that this is an ensemble film in those first 5 minutes. So I wrote this intro where we're going to be, where we use the landscape of the town to weave everybody together, you know, physically, so that we know everybody's on top of each other and we tease all the different storylines. So with that, I was like, you know, let's start with Taylor on his bike, throw the music on, you know, that was like, you know, sort of this fun little thing to get us into that it's a music movie.
Yeah.
And then I envisioned it was going to be like, we go like out over a gorge and find them on the other side, but then we found this location. And our DP's son, Cameron, is like the premier drone operator. So we flew Cameron out and he just was able to just crush this amazing drone shot for us. And it was perfect because I didn't even, as I'm watching it, I'm like, this is such a long shot. What am I going to do with this? You know, but then I'm like, well, let's just do a proper opening credit sequence, you know, like people would do with these sorts of movies back in the day. So, yeah, I mean, I love that shot, and it's a shot that's very dear to me, you know.
And how about the bar shot? We're talking about you only had a limited amount of time to shoot there, and part of the reason, was it that first, that one shot sequence where you're going through following everyone? You start with a two shot with Hayden and, was it Ian?
No, we start with the two shot with Eller and Elena.
Okay.
So, yeah, we start with, there's this, like, joke where Elena says, we look like a depressing version of a Norman Rockwell painting.
Yes, yes.
And we cut to the recreation of, it's kind of like a mashup of Prom and Soda Jerk, those two Rockwell paintings. And so we cut back to that shot, and then Ella and Callan, Taylor and Dana, dance through it, and then we follow them, and we go around them a couple times for their scene. They drift off to the left, and then we rack to Eller, who's coming back out of the bathroom. We track with him kind of diagonally, find him with Justin Chatwin, come follow back with Eller as he gets Elena to leave, and then the bouncer comes and then throws
where do you even start with coordinating something like this and blocking it? Like, what, as a director,
how many takes did you guys do?
We did 11 takes.
Right. But that's like actually not that many when you really think about the like mechanics of getting that right.
Right.
I mean, you have crew everywhere, right? So you need to clear everyone from the who's going to be in the shot. It's a lot of like coordination, and I think, I mean, I will say that our DP, Michael Fitzmaurice, is a beast, and he's an amazing cinematographer, but he's also been an operator on really, really big movies.
Yeah.
He was on Batman.
Yeah, he shot the famous scene in Batman where the button didn't work for the Joker, and the hospital blew up behind him.
Oh, wow.
So he shot and he knows
he's
how
a great
to
operator.
Really, yeah, he's a really great operator, so he was very nimble and was really able, I think, to dance around the people that needed him to get the shot. So that was a big part of it, was just having, and super down. Like, you can find people and crew that, you know, they're just used to kind of being maybe on a TV show where it's very much more like paced out and methodical, and there's coverage. And exactly. So to have somebody who can go a little guerrilla style, like, and really get into it to get the shot is really what is a big part of why that was so successful.
Yeah, but so with that shot, I was just like, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. The cast was like, you know, I think Ella Hunt especially was really excited because she's like, it's like a play.
Yeah.
You know, it's just such a more heightened day of shooting when you're trying to do a 2.5 minute take that everything has to go right before you can move on, you know, and you know you've got 9 pages to shoot that day. So for us, you know, but I love that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I think that is just so much fun. And you know, you should. I probably should have picked up a little piece of coverage just in case. Like, I really like doing roaming master shots and then going in and punching out the coverage. Like, there's a couple things where in the movie where like when the show is over and we're back outside and we bring Eller and Victoria out. We're on Victoria, and then he turns back around and he finds Rabbit and Chris. You know, we go into coverage at that point, but the way we shot that master was just one big roaming master, knowing like, okay, we have to go back and clean it up.
Okay, sorry, I have to interrupt for a second to explain this next part because it's amazing. Okay, so our waitress, she was so sweet, and she overheard us talking about films and the Atlanta Film Festival, so she started asking Joseph and Audrey about their movie. And they start talking about watching movies at home versus watching them in a theater, and the waitress name drops a specific movie that has a direct connection to Summer Night without any knowledge of anything about this movie. It's like a legit direct connection. It was super crazy. Anyway, let's get back to it, shall we?
Do you have a film in it?
We do.
Our film played last night. It's called Summer Night.
Yeah.
It's a fun...
about a group of friends in a small town over the course of one night wrestling with their various relationship troubles.
Yeah. Is it going to be like, what kind of release is it? It's a 10-screen release, and then it's also going to come out on like the streaming platforms and like
on
iTunes.
On the same day.
Because that's just how things go nowadays. Yeah. For all the people that don't want to get off their couches.
Some movies are meant to be seem private. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
totally.
You just, it sinks in a little bit more.
Oh, yeah.
But then there are other movies that are so jarring that it's like, you need to have a group present.
Totally.
You need that energy.
Everybody in it together.
Yeah. Yep. It's like Boyhood. Like, we're in this.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
That's so funny you said Boyhood, because Eller, the young man that's in that, is in our film.
Is he?
Yeah. That's so funny you said that
he's
movie.
He's all grown up now.
Yeah.
He's a man now.
He is.
So
yeah. He's in our movie. That's so funny you said that. It was a perfect person to bring up.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, I just heard you talking.
Yeah, no, not at all. Thank you.
That's amazing. I can't believe she said Boyhood.
What are the chances?
You know, to do those roaming masters and then punch in, obviously super economical.
Yeah.
Like, you can get so much done, and it feels like you've done a lot more, you know what I mean? And we always wanted to have, like a lot of character-inspired camera movements.
Yeah.
So, but to get back to how awesome Michael Fitzmaurice is for a second, you know, I always envisioned coming into the Alamo as, like, the lights pop on the marquee, we dip down, we find the guys, the cop car pulls up.
There's a little bit of a Boogie Nights vibe.
Totally,
to it.
Yeah. Good call. Totally, yeah, like that opening where they come from the car shot into the club.
Inspired by, yeah, and then, you know, we hide a cut in the curtain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Theoretically hide a cut in the curtain.
I love being a film snob, but part of the problem with one-shots is I'm always like, okay,
where's the cut?
Yeah, exactly.
We went through Birdman and found all the
right?
cuts.
Yeah. So we're like, they're somewhere,
you know,
we're going to find them.
Somewhere.
But, you know, what was really cool is I said to, you know, I had met with some DPs, and a lot of people, when I was telling them about that shot, they were like, oh, that's going to be really hard and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't know when we got Michael. I told it to him, and he was like, that's cool. Why don't you put a time-lapse at the beginning of it? So that's what inspired the when we go in tonight, right from the clock tower, you know, we go into the night, and Dan Kreese, our music composer, did this amazing job. I was like, you know, I want it to feel like the band is warming up,
right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I also want it to fit with
the music that we have.
Have the music fit with the movement and the thing and all that. So that's how that came about. And that's another one of the shots that we worked really hard on.
And just to chime in on the you know, as a like the producing side of things, like when you are interviewing and you're trying to find a good collaborative partner in terms of your DP for your director, a great litmus test is if someone says, hey, I have this great idea for this shot, and someone's like, that's really going to be hard.
Right.
That's, you know, you're right there, you can see that there's maybe going to be a lot of pushback, and when there's someone's kind of more of a no, as opposed to a, wait, that's cool, I'm going to think about that, and then maybe have another great idea.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a great learning lesson for us in terms of, you know, crewing up, and like who you decide to go with, and like how game people are to play, and like think of creative ways to get something done, as opposed to saying, well, that seems harder, I don't think that we can do that, or we don't have the equipment for it, or whatever.
Break that up into coverage.
Right,
yeah.
Why don't you just lock it off and like break it up, and you know, it's something more traditional. It's like you can see where people's excitement lies, and you know, I think that getting Michael was a huge coup for our movie.
It was.
And
I imagine it's also, you don't want someone to compromise what you're going for. It's like if someone comes in and says like, you're kind of like, all right, well.
You want somebody to be like, oh, that's cool. You know what else we could do?
Yes.
You know, you want people to be seeing what you're going for and building on it and making it that much better.
Yeah. And it feels like, you know, you're kind of getting like your, like, I don't know, like, I'm not a comic book person, but like almost like your like crew together to like go fight evil. Like once you know who your team is,
right,
like you can accomplish things that seem really hard, you know. And our editor, Ray Wood, was hugely instrumental in the same way of like once we were all in the edit, you know, being very game to try new things and see if something works. And that was, you know, because, you know, when you're filming something, the compliment to it is how you edit it, right?
Yeah.
So it's if you can have the vision ahead of time to see how it could go in the edit, you know, those two things. And we got very lucky having two amazing collaborators in that sense.
I wanted to ask about the editing, because there was, I know you were mentioning there were some snags you were running into looking at some of the cuts and how he helped you kind of work through it and figure out the beats.
We did everything together. So Ray was like, you know, we sat down and he was like, well, take me through the script and I'll get you your first assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just hanging out in Atlanta. I'm like, let's just start cutting. So Ray and I did the first assembly together. So, you know, there was not a single cut that I wasn't there choosing with Ray. So that was really fun, you know. So we worked on that together, you know, and I think most people, you know, you hear about everybody, your first cut makes you sick to your stomach, and it was, we did that first cut together, you know, and so Ray and I were just like thick as thieves, dug in.
Did it make you sick to your stomach, though?
The whole process makes you sick to your stomach, yeah. I mean, you're sick the whole time.
But until somebody comes into the edit and laughs, then then everyone, the tension is relieved.
Right.
And you're like, okay, good, it worked. Yeah. Okay, we're not just in this little hole together laughing.
But I mean, there were big things that we had to work super hard on. You know, scenes that really changed a lot once we got into the edit because, you know, there were certain things about the script that people didn't totally understand. There were moments that we didn't fully, like, we never fully dialed in, you know what I mean? And we thought it was dialed in, but then once you show it to people, like, I don't totally understand what this, that, or the other. And so those are the moments where you can start really making magic in the edit because you can do anything, you know? And I mean, you would never know it, but there's split screens all over our movie. Mm-hmm. You know, we use a lot of visual effects, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's again.
Ray did all that himself.
Exactly. From a production side, you know, to have somebody who's game to do some VFX, you know, we're not doing some crazy, like, animatronic anything that comes in and, you know, we're just doing some little fixes, but to have an editor that's game and savvy enough to have learned a little bit of those skills while being able to, you know, do a basic assembly and editing is huge. Yeah. And, like, to have somebody who's just willing to throw some stuff in. Joe's got a little cameo, you know, like, just as a little
Where's
wash.
Your cameo?
Oh. I missed it. So we had
it's
a...
It's so gotta, subtle.
We gotta go,
you
gotta
never
show it
know.
Again.
You
I gotta go back.
You never
but
know.
There was a... We wanted to do this cut where we had really nothing to cut on. It's like it's the moment when Taylor is walking out of the bar to go see Ella's character, and Victoria and Eller had just walked in, and she said, like, oh, she's cute, want to get a drink? Yeah. We had nothing to cut on, so we did me, like, just walking past towards the bar on a green screen. So it's just a quick wipe of the frame, but that's what we used for the cut. And we did that we just threw up a green screen in Ray's office and used, like, whatever camera they had.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
And we just threw it in there. Yeah, that's my camera. Wait, I also have me and my friend Justin Lerner, I was telling you about, are the audio of the game show that Victoria's sister is watching when you come into her
house. I also got tasked with being the waitress with the body bag is pulled out. I'm, like, standing by the door.
God.
Our daughter is the little baby
right,
in the scene. So
and
it's,
our dog is Gus.
And our dog is the dog that he's holding.
In the scene where you meet the druggy kids.
Yeah. I love that. That moment is such a... It's an interesting, almost jarring, but you play it for a really brilliant comedic moment where he's kind of like the moment where they bring the body out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he goes, well, I guess the food finally killed somebody, which is a laugh that... I feel like the nervousness is will that laugh play off? And it seemed to respond, or the audience responded real well to it, and I thought it was very funny. But that was such an interesting, like, was that just kind of a, like, these guys are living their lives, and here's the world kind of outside their little bubble?
Yeah, I mean, what it really is, like, you know, the film is very much about, like, are you going to be Justin Chatwin's character Andy, or are you going to be Chris Davis's character Luke? You know what I mean? There's going to be sacrifices no matter how you decide to live your life. Whether you're going to be an eternal bachelor, forever indulgent, like, no responsibility, no care in the world, or are you going to get married and have kids and start being more self-sacrificial? So I think that, and so that moment with the ambulance is really just sort of a reminder for the characters of their own mortality.
Right.
And so that's really what that beat is. And it is funny and strange. And I think when you first see it, you're like, did one of the characters die?
Right.
And then when Rabbit says, food finally killed someone, you know it wasn't, but it was just a random person keeping them from the diner. So, you know, I always felt, and people often are like, what? Wait, what? Like,
well, it's completely, at the moment, it's completely out of tone with, it's like, oh my
totally
God, it just got real.
Right. Yeah. And then Rabbit lightens it again.
Yeah.
But I think especially for Eller's character, I think that moment does something to inspire the the little chat that he gives by the fire. You know, I can't just hang out with you assholes forever. I gotta do something with my life. And so, you know, it is a heavier moment in the movie, but it doesn't last super long, and it breaks it with a really fun comment.
Yeah.
And so, and it was actually my little brother James in the body bag.
Who is a family affair.
It was a family affair, and James was he worked as a PA, and then kind of grew into a bigger role in the film. And so it was, for us, it's like the whole process is a very family affair, and there's lots of little hidden.
Whoever was available.
Yeah, it was like, all right, who's got the right size and is not doing anything?
Well, talk about assembling the family in terms of the cast. Who did you cast first? What were those conversations like? I love the little anecdote Anna Lee had about I complained about everything. So talk a little bit about casting. Those conversations early on where people would come to you and say, I don't like this. How do you kind of navigate that while not necessarily abandoning what you love? Like, how do you find those compromises?
Eller was the first person on.
Eller was the first person cast, and we put the movie together about a year and a half before we started shooting, and we just couldn't find the financing for it, and it kind of fell by the wayside. And then once we geared back up, we reapproached the people, and whoever was available, we got to keep. And so, I only think we had to recast like one or two parts, but basically, I would just like, we didn't have a casting director, so I would.
We had IMDb.
Yeah,
that was our casting director.
IMDb Pro, and so we would just scour lists of other films, basically. Like, so when I was looking for the Taylor role, I'm looking through the Stanford Prison Experiment. I'm like, there's gotta be somebody in this movie that makes sense.
And there were lots of great people in the movie. It was really great. I mean, that was a great little movie to dip into for young men.
Yeah. So I'd seen Callan in I Am Number 4 when he was really young, and I remember thinking, that's a very talented actor.
Yeah.
And I just started watching interviews with him, and I was like, I think this is our guy. I shot his manager an email late at night. He wrote me right back. I sat down with him. He wanted to do it, and that was that. And it was kind of the same thing with everybody. Some people were at the same agency as me, and so I knew a lot of their agents because I worked with them for a long time. And then other people, it also kind of snowballs,
Okay, so at this point, the waitress brought our food. We decided to take a quick break to eat. So if you want to really be part of this immersive experience, if you need to take a bathroom break, if you want to grab some food, now would be a great time to do it. Also, when we got back and started recording again, Hayden Cito had joined us. This is that Stan Lee cameo I was telling you about. It's here. It's happening. So he hangs out a little bit. All right. Enough with the interruption. Back to the show.
All right. Well, this is great because I was going to say we were talking about casting.
Yeah.
And this beautiful man just arrived. But tell me a little bit about continuing on from that process of LR was cast and then getting everybody else involved too.
Do you want me to hold that so you can eat your food?
You were man, you're going to get a co-producer credit on this.
Balance it on this latte cup. I was saying, we didn't have a casting director, so it was just going through lists to find people that we thought were right, and then for the most part, I didn't meet with more than one person for any of the roles. I just would, like with Hayden, for example, we're at the same agency, so they sent me a list of however many people, and just his tape just immediately popped right out to me, and I was like, I think this guy would be fantastic as Caleb. Let's see if he likes it. Send it to him. He liked it. We sat down at the Republic of Pi in Burbank. He wanted to do it, and we said, let's go, you know what I mean? Because the audition process is a little bit ridiculous, to be honest. You're auditioning people that you know can act, right? All these people can act. They've already, it's one thing if you're casting, a 10-year-old or somebody who's never been in a film before, or a newcomer, whatever. I understand needing them to read the lines and everything, but if you know your script and you know these people's work, what they can do.
Through that too, so personally how frustrating it is.
I've been through
it.
I think Joe
couldn't stomach putting people through an audition process.
Was
like, this is karmically wrong. Right.
Cannibalistic. I was never going to do it. And it's just unnecessary. And I think a lot of it is, sometimes maybe ego for the filmmakers, especially first timers, I get to audition all these, you know, actors, right. whatever, and it's just not my, you know, I wasn't into it. So it was stuff like that. You know, some were like tapes that agents put in front of me, like Hayden's, where I was like, this reel is amazing. This guy's going to kill this, you know, especially with Hayden with Caleb. Like, we rely on him for a lot of the humor in the film, you know right. what I mean? While with Annalie's character, we rely on her to root the film emotionally. And so when I got on the phone with Annalie and she was sort of telling me more intimate details about her life and what she felt about the character, I, in those conversations, I realized, you know, we had script problems and we had to go back and we really had to rewrite so that we respected how difficult this situation was for her. It wasn't to be played for laughs, which is how it was originally written, was that, you know, this moment of her being pregnant is, you know, she was originally crying with snot bubbles and blah, blah, whatever.
And like kind of being like, you know, you're so like a bad boyfriend.
It was more
stuff.
Played for laughs.
It was more played for laughs. And also there was no, in the original script, resolution between what they're going to do with the kids, so with the baby. And yeah. so we were down in Noonan and we were talking through it, and Audrey, you know, had been pregnant. And so, you know, first of all, and you could ask Annalie, I swear Annalie got on the phone with me to pass on the project. That she got on the phone with me to, like, be polite right. and tell me, like, thank no. you for thinking of me, but no. Yeah. But we talked for, like, an hour and 40 minutes, and by the end...
Joe is very persistent.
It's like, first 2 minutes, I'm like, mayday, mayday, we're going down. Let's turn the ship. How do we do this? How do we get her on board? So, you know, and so everybody, so somebody like that specifically, you know, when you cast them, you then go back and tweak the writing. And, you know, we always needed a resolution to the Seth Mel thing, right? And we were trying to figure out what is it. And as originally scripted, it was like, Mel's problem is that Seth won't come and talk to her. But Mel's problem is she's pregnant, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She wants to talk to Seth so she can figure it out. She wants to get his perspective. What does he want? She wants to include him. And that's why it's so offensive to her when he says...
It's not my call.
It's not my call. You right. do what you want.
Right. Which was something that we talked a lot about, because having been, like, a younger person, you know, I was in my, like, mid to late 20s when I got pregnant. And obviously, we were, you know, a little bit more of a stable family situation, personally. But, you know, just being faced with... You know, the wait, I am pregnant. It's not a theoretical, like,
it's happening.
Could I
it's
be?
It's real.
Or would I, it's here. So what do you need from somebody? And then how are you digesting? And we were really trying to make it personal for her and not just about my boyfriend's being, like, a crappy boyfriend. And, you know, kind of female characters sometimes, especially when they're written by men, I'm not saying all men, but sometimes people don't quite understand the nuance of, like, a female perspective. And so we were trying to bring something to the table for her where she was grappling with her own life outside of him, right? I am in school. Like, this was not my plan to, like, get knocked up and then have to, you know, have my life bifurcated by a kid, right? So I, like, that was a big part of giving her depth, was bringing her own inner conflict to the conversation, and then also having her, like, female friends there to support in that way, versus just her, like, complaining about how crappy her boyfriend is being, right?
Right. I was gonna ask about that, like, in terms of finding the balance, because it is very male-dominated, but there is a lot of the female perspective in there, and just the process of getting it up to that point. Was the script originally focused on both sides as much as... It
no,
ended up in the final film.
We were rewriting the female characters from
top to
day
bottom.
One.
Yeah. You know, Jordan did a great job. You know, the script had a lot of, like, fun. He's really good at writing, like, very quick little funny
dialogue
moments.
Situations.
Some of the characters, you know... Again, with how we cast it, you know, just needed to get curbed towards the person we put in that role, right?
Right.
And it needed to complement them and also resonate with what they saw in the character. So if they were like, yeah, I like this, you know, like what Annalie said last night, I she liked certain parts, but there needed to be some fixes.
Right.
That was our responsibility to serve our actors in that way and not be precious with anything. So Joe was really great about just kind of going in with a scalpel and like adjusting certain scenes. And then obviously, you know, a big part of it is just being able to be loose on the day and let your actors like ad-lib something or just make it their own and not be super, super precious about it.
I was gonna say something I really loved is, I feel like you don't see it as much. I feel like in these kinds of movies, males in particular, it's like, all right, let's go out, we're gonna bang everything and get drunk. The males in this movie are so sensitive and almost, they're more emotional.
They
are. And like, typically the type is like, the males are like, yeah, we're great. You don't see a lot of romance stuff. And the females are always emotional and like, oh, what do? It's almost like flipped in this. But it's very genuine. So was that something you were consciously trying to upend, like kind of like the guys are more emotional and more in tune?
I think I'm just a much more emotional person, and that, you know, is what comes, you know, maybe that's why the characters skew that way. And you know, there was a lot, you know, so like I said, Jordan and I worked on the script for like over 2 years. So the scene with Hayden, with Caleb, when they're on the bench, where he says, Mel's pregnant, and he says, what the fuck is wrong with you, you know? That was originally written as Caleb saying, like, it's gonna be okay, man. And I'm like, no, he needs to say something, like, this is a mistake. And then Jordan wrote this amazing dialogue, particularly this wonderful joke, this is in 1937.
Right.
And same with Ian's scene with Chris. Originally, that scene was Chris said something like, wait, is Mel pregnant? And then said, like, don't worry, man, you're gonna be okay. I'm like, no, dig him in further. You know what I mean? And he wrote this wonderful stuff about, have you ever been to a one-year-old's birthday party? Which is so funny and has great perspective on it. So, yeah, I mean, it's an emotional... The characters, they're artists, you know what I mean? They are, like, poetic souls. They're musicians.
Joe also has a group of friends, like a group of like 6 or 7 guy friends that they've been friends stretching from like kindergarten on through high school. Yeah. And I like having just been around everybody, they all support each other in this very like male way, but it's also very emotional and very like dug into a like a sense of knowing the person for so long. And I think that was a big part of like the emotional life that he was able to bring to these characters, which is these like long-lasting friendships, but that also are like there emotionally to support each other, not just like be dudes. And,
well, I love that. You know, I love that because personally, it's something I relate to real strongly as well. And I have groups of friends who I've talked to, but it's like I love seeing
emotional men.
Exactly. I feel like we need more of that.
But, totally. We need strong women, we need emotional men.
Exactly.
Let's drag Hayden in.
Hayden, what's up?
Hey,
I feel bad. I don't want to make you talk too loudly because I know you're not feeling well, but thank you for hanging out.
We're talking a little bit about just casting and how you got involved. I know we talked a little bit about it on the red carpet, but what you brought to the table, and in terms of looking at the script and saying, like, okay, here's what I like, here's what I don't like, did you already love what you saw on the page, or what did you want to bring
to Caleb? I really enjoy characters that wear their heart under their sleeves, you know, and you don't see many male characters doing that, like you said. And I think it was very refreshing that, you know, I got to do that, and on top of that, play a musician that I've always wanted to do. And yeah, I loved everything about the script. I'm a big fan of the coming of age genre, because I think it's like every mission statement of like film.
Yeah.
You know, it's supposed to make you reevaluate your life and, you know, give yourself some perspective. And I think that, Summer Night really did that for me. So I was really in.
It was so perfect because he's not only got phenomenal comic timing, but also tremendous emotional depth. So, you know, there was nobody just playing anything just for laughs. But then also people found the moments that were funny and understood them and, you know, made the most of them.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about, I know you brought it up last night during the Q&A, Hayden, but the moments when things were just so stressful, and I know there were some struggles with the production as it was going on, but I think you described it as you, the only time you knew Joe was upset was, going into your sanctuary.
Yeah.
What are some, like, just in terms of trying to overcome that stuff, and also talk a little bit about what the struggle was to get it made, and that about halfway through there were some issues with the funding.
Yeah, I mean, the when we were actually shooting, it was a reprieve, and any sort of shirt over my head, I think it was just me focusing. I wasn't really stressed. I was usually very happy in my little cocoon.
Right.
We basically, I mean, the long and short of it is we had financier is a strong word, because he turned out to just be a person with no actual money, and I think he just was, I think this is a long, elaborate scheme to get a selfie with Victoria is really what my,
I have no idea what his... It was a very, like...
reason or his end game.
Yeah, it was a very strange thing, because we were like, what is he trying to gain from this? Because really, it was just kind of a bunch of lies that we were naive enough to believe for a time. And, you know, ultimately, with these kinds of things, you know, we came out, I guess, victorious in the end, because we were able to, with the great luck of who we hired and the crew that were able to come in and help us, and then also the companies that came in to help us with funding, you know, we were able to survive. But it was a moment where you kind of have to go, okay, it was a total shit show, right. And it was horrible in the moment, and we thought we were down and never getting up. And we were basically, it was the day before Halloween that SAG called all of our actors and said, do not go to set. And so we were like, okay, well, maybe we're done. Maybe we just have a big party and, you know, we put it there. And then, you know, it was about being honest with our crew, and everyone just kind of came together, like, really supportive. And I think everyone believed in the movie and actually wanted to see it get made and see it finished. So that was a huge, like, I think, compliment to Joe in terms of his leadership. And, you know, it just showed how much people believed in it. And, you know, we've told the story since in L.A., and everyone's like, that never happens. Yeah. Like, your crew's like, they're like, we're out of here.
It's incredible.
We were really fortunate. I mean, basically what happened was we had the money for pre-production, and then this person was supposed to come in for production and for post, and it just slowly, the money was not coming in on time, and we hadn't properly structured the operating agreement, which was another nightmare and something we didn't know enough about. And we just did, we went down because we couldn't afford to keep going, and then we had this huge, like, 36-hour fundraising period where we were able to raise enough money to come back up, and we did.
Make it happen. Yeah. So bring into the table your experience as an actor when directing. What are some personal experiences you've had where you're like, okay, this is something, if I ever get to a point where I'm directing someday, I want to make sure I keep this in mind, and things you wanted to avoid as well. How did you approach working with actors as an actor, and just lessons you've learned along the way and your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think just giving people, like, respecting people and giving them space to do their thing and giving them room to experiment and to fail and to succeed, and knowing that they're held and that you're not going to put anything bad in that doesn't work in the movie, but you want them to be able to feel free to try things out. You know, I think that I've watched first-time filmmakers grip the project way too tight and miss out on so much that other people are trying to bring to it. So for me with that, yeah, with the acting, that was like the really big thing. It's like hiring the right people and letting them do their thing, and then sort of gently steering them into the direction, and, you know, if we go too far off, bringing it back and knowing, like, okay, well, that's not going to work in the movie, but it's okay that we played with it, it's fun, and let's bring it back. And also, people have very different styles of working. You know, some people really want to talk through a lot on the day, which is difficult because you don't have a lot of time. Some people want to talk a lot beforehand so that on the day they don't have to do a lot of talking. That's kind of the way that I like to work. And then there's some people that just want to go and do their thing, you know what I mean? And you just trust them to go and do it, and it's great. And some people are really great at improvisation, like Hayden and Justin. Other actors really stick much more to the script, and that's how they excel. And so I think trying quickly to figure out what everybody's process is and how to make everybody feel comfortable and understand they're there because they're the only person that could possibly ever play this role, and to trust what their instincts are and not doubt themselves, and, you know, just kind of give it their all and know that once we get into the edit, we're going to make everybody look good. And
what are some lessons you're taking from this that you're going to... they're going to be with you forever on future projects as a director, as a producer, as an actor? Like, what kind of stuff did you learn from this that you think is extremely valuable moving forward?
always have all the money in the bank before you start.
Oh man, yeah.
Like, I mean, no, don't trust anyone and what they say, even if they're your family member or friend.
No.
It's you know, it's just it's for the safety of everybody, right. You know. It's the right way to do it. You know, we kind of jumped in full force in a very novice
so
way,
naive,
so naive. But again, it worked out in our favor. Luckily, we got very lucky. But I think also, you know, making sure that, you know, you give time for the casting process, you give time for the crew hiring process, especially your key crew members who are going to be leading their departments, and making sure that, you know, those people are see the vision that is being kind of made by the director and the writer, you know, and the actors, and that they can support that, and that, you know, they have a sense of duty to lead their departments and their crew. And I think, you know, the people that we worked with that, you know, we already kind of earmarked, we're like, we're going to work with these people a lot. We want to make this our team. You know, that's huge. And as a producer, it's like, when you start collecting your people, that you're like, I always want to work with them because I know I can trust them. And I don't, the person I work for now, he says, I don't want to think about you. If you're somebody I don't have to think about, that's a great thing because I know that I can basically trust you,
like
your
yeah.
judgment. And if there's a problem, you're making the right judgment call most of the time, which, you know, it's a little aggressive, but I kind of like it. You know, I don't have to think about you. So that would be, you know, the takeaway from the experience.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I think we've met, like, people that we want to collaborate with forever on this movie. You know, Michael Fitzmaurice, our cinematographer, Aaron Knight, our costume designer, Raymond Wood, obviously our editor, and, you know, tons of people from the crew and the whole cast I would love to work with again. So that's really wonderful that you feel like you've kind of had a team, because that, you know, when I was making my first movie, I hadn't done shorts, I didn't go to film school, so I was really putting the whole thing together from scratch. So that was really great, and, you know, I just want to do this for the rest of my life, so how can I make that happen, you know?
Yeah. Like,
right, on to the next.
Yeah, I mean, I have this other thing that I'm really excited about that I really hope we get to make.
Yeah.
It's this book called This Is Not a Love Letter by a writer named Kim Purcell. And I have this wonderful young writer named Brianna Belser who's doing the adaptation. She's actually from Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Coming back.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that is, it's a little bit similar in age group. It's the two leads are 18, so they're younger than the people in this movie. But it's kind of a more intense story, and
gotcha.
It's got a more driving storyline, which I think was something, what I loved making this movie, and it's all these interweaving things and this ambling, you know, way of telling a story, a little bit ambling, but I think that what I was like, next time I really want a hard driving story, and the way that this story is structured, it's these two people who are 18, a young black man and a young white girl. They're in a small town in Oregon. He was originally from Brooklyn. She's originally from the town. They've been dating for 11 months. They get into a fight as graduation's approaching. She decides she wants to go on a one-week break, and he disappears during that break. And so the movie opens, and she discovers that she's disappeared. And then there are two storylines that run parallel. She and the town and everybody are trying to figure out what happened to this young man, while she's also remembering back to when they first met and how they fell in love and their relationship leading up to that point. She's sort of trying to uncover what clues might lead to what happened, as well as we're getting to see this love story. So it's like a thriller mystery love story simultaneous. So,
all of the above.
Yeah,
get it all in there.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that we can make that, but it's like, as soon as we have that script, then it's going to be on the grind, on the muscle, trying to figure out how we're going to do it.
That sounds awesome, though.
Yeah.
I'm excited for that. So, last question. We talked about Missing Frames, seeing the movies that you know you need to see.
Yes.
What, and all three of you, feel free to chime in. These are my podcast, basically, we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. So what's the missing frame from your life that you know you need to see, that you want to get around to?
Well, there's so many. I've never seen Apocalypse Now. I know. So see, that's what everyone does to
me.
They're like,
anytime someone that's like how I know. I'm like, that's gotta be
episode. I think it's like something I've like maybe avoided intentionally because I know it's gonna be so intense, and I want to like be in the right space and like give my full attention. But that's one I know I need to see, and I'll correct it soon because I am tired of, not that you were scoffing at me, but I'm tired of being like, oh, you've never seen
how
that.
Dare you?
Like, I know it.
We're halfway through Decalogue, which I had never seen.
Oh, wow.
tell me
more about that. I don't even know that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've watched 4 out of the 10.
It's the Polish filmmaker, and it's brilliant, it's gorgeous, it's so heart-wrenching.
Audrey watched the first one while the kids were asleep. She's like, I didn't know we were watching a fucking dead children movie.
I was like, what the hell is this? Middle of my day watching this like insanely sad.
What a pleasant surprise.
Just like crying. And what's amazing about watching, not to jump on your pick here, but to watch a movie that's, you know, a foreign language, right? So you're following along in subtitles and you know, obviously sometimes you tune out for a second or you look away and you don't know what's going on. But the strength of the filmmaking is so strong. You follow the emotional thread beautifully. And that I think is such an amazing example of good filmmaking. Yeah. You don't need to know what people are saying to understand what's happening in the emotional like life of the characters and the story.
This is a completely unrelated story. I'm so sorry to interrupt. This is, when I saw Kill Bill Volume 1, the subtitles had been turned off for some reason. So during all the scenes where she's talking to
Hattori Hanzo.
Yes, Hattori Hanzo. I was like, oh, what and this is the first Tarantino movie I'd seen too. I was like, what an interesting artistic choice. I guess I'll just go with this. And about halfway through, I was like, no. And I turned it on, I was like, oops, that's great.
But kind of cool. Yeah, like, it's a fantastic, great experiment.
But it's true. I mean, the power of filmmaking.
Yeah. Yep. But even in that scene, like, you didn't need the subtitles.
You knew exactly what's going on. That's why
she's here to look for him.
Right.
Not telling him that she's looking for him.
It was Lucy Liu was doing her whole business meeting. I was like, oh, I probably am supposed to know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And then she chops off someone's head. I'm like, oh, never mind.
But the Japanese way of acting is so... it's so big.
Yes.
That you kind of do know. It's like theater. Like, so you kind of know what's going on.
What about you, Hayden? What's your missing frame?
Recently, I've been meaning to watch Roma. It's on Netflix. It's right there. I just, like Audrey said, I'm just not in the right mindset. Like, I'll start it for, like, 20 seconds. I'm like, it's so sad. It feels really sad already.
Oh.
And then I'm like, oh, she's washing her dishes. It's so sad. I need to wash my dishes too. And then I'm like, and then I'll pause it and then I'll like watch like a Marvel movie or something. But like as an artist, as an actor, I'm like, I need to do better than this. It was hard for me to get into, but I do plan to finish it.
Nice. Well, when is the film officially going to be available? Summer night. When is it available for people to watch, to stream, to go see?
Yeah, it'll be out July 12th on all the platforms, you know, iTunes, Amazon, etc. And it will also be out in theaters in 10 select cities. So we will update everyone as we know them. We hope Atlanta, but definitely LA.
Okay.
I imagine Atlanta's going to be gonna be one of them, and LA will certainly be one.
Yeah, and then you know a couple other cities, major cities in the U.S. As the modern day is, it's going to be on all the platforms, so you don't have to leave the comfort of your home.
Is there social media where people should be following
you? Yeah, it's at Summer Night Movie on Instagram. I'm not sure if we have a Twitter, but you know, Instagram is the flavor of the moment. So yes, we are on Instagram and we'll be updating all the information there, and
awesome.
And our cast will hopefully be putting some stuff out as well as,
better be.
As the release date approaches.
Yeah.
The power of social media, no pressure.
Well, thank you all so much. I really appreciate
it.
It's a wonderful movie. So congratulations.
Thank you.